I came back out and I'm like shaking and I'm pale, you know, he's just standing there looking at his watch. And I'm like, coach, I threw up. And he's like, well, you better swim that off then.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 120 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Sam and I wiggle art a little bit.
And today is October 17th. 2017. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything can happen on this show. There's going to be profanity, and also we're going to talk about business,
yeah,
life,
all sorts of things,
all kinds of stuff. So if you just can't handle it,
we're going to go deep. So grab your waders.
Yeah, buckle your shoes, pilgrim. Let's do this. Okay. Also, Adam is not here this week, so we are two humaning it.
But we do have an update on him, which is that he is doing much better.
Yes.
He apparently realized that he was experiencing the frog boiling phenomenon, wherein by slowly feeling worse and worse and worse, he didn't realize the extent to which he was feeling very bad. So, yeah, so now he's
in
great.
A state now where he has an incredible cold slash sort of sore throat thing. Plus, his stomach is now wrapped around his esophagus.
It's just one of the, when it rains, it pours, man.
And he's like, I've never felt better. I think he's contagious, so he's staying home.
I do want to talk about this real quick, though, because I think this seems like a family problem that we have, which is the inability to recognize when maybe we should get medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
So this happened now with Adam in this case, months gone by before he's like, maybe I should get this taken care of.
It was more like years.
Probably years. Yeah. In my case with the cancer thing, same thing. I thought I was fine, and then I got the scan, and they're like, we don't know how you're alive.
Well, we have a tendency to brute force our way through things, through either drugs or exercise.
Most recent one, that was our mom. Mm-hmm. Turns out she literally has no rotator cuff.
Yeah, she forgot about that. She left it somewhere. It's gone.
She's been using her arm, but the doctor
said
it's been
using
thing.
It. He's like, I don't know. How is this arm on? How's this attached to your body?
So what's our deal? What's that about?
I don't know. It's that you know, Midwestern farmer background. Mm-hmm. You know, you just
gotta get the work done.
Yeah, we got the stories we have of our tough grandpa.
Oh my God,
man. Well, maybe we'll tell him someday. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, it's October, which October means something to us as a studio, because every single October it's like a hurricane.
Yep.
It's not a month. It's a sort of a debris-flinging, chaotic...
It's a storm.
Turbulent storm.
It's a temporal storm.
So everything always happens all at once in October.
And this is the crazy thing is there's always no warning. This happens every single time.
All of a sudden, everything is due.
So we were just hanging out the last week of September. We're like, well, everything's going great. Things are going good. You know, we got everything under wraps. And then suddenly...
Just cruising.
I think it was October 2nd.
Yep.
Things just started getting dumped.
Yep.
And we're like, oh God. And then they just kept coming. So we've been handling a lot of stuff.
Yeah. We've got so Sam and Monique are heading over to California for business.
Do business.
Starting tomorrow. So the day that the podcast goes live, they'll be in the air, flying over there. They'll be gone for a few days. And we have Sam and I have been working on a couple talks, which got approved for an important event, and we were given a 4 weeks to do them starting at the beginning of October.
Right. Naturally.
Yep. And we also have a very big launch event happening pretty soon, which is now a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking about that next week.
It's not Scuffle Buddies for those.
It's not Scuffle Buddies.
Just to clarify.
It's not Scuffle Buddies. But it's us bringing Crashlands somewhere new.
Yeah.
So that's all I'll say about that. But that's been a huge project in the works for a really long time. And we thought it was going to happen in like March.
Yep.
But nope, it's got to happen in around October because October. So anyways, and also the St. Louis Scatter Jam happened this last weekend. And we were planning on attending. And this is actually one of the, I think we've only missed one other St. Louis game jam.
Yeah. It was also going to be the first time that the entire like 7-person studio was going to be around.
Yeah. We were so pumped.
And then Adam was out because he's got some holes in his guts.
Yep.
And then, then all this other stuff was just sort of just perfect storming, perfect Octobering all over.
Yeah. And I had to go to a wedding last weekend. So I missed a day.
Oh my Lord. It's been crazy.
So I think this does speak to, what it means to really be burned out, you know, where, because I think last week I had been going so hard on everything, trying to keep up that, I mean, and you can see it if you do have access to the Scuffle Buddies patch notes, which I'm not going to broadcast the link to, but some people have it. Mm-hmm. As you can see, sort of like over the past 2 weeks, my patch notes went from, you know, like 15 to 20 items a day down to like 5 to 7. or there would be like a couple days where I would not post patch notes because I was piling up, you know, changes because like the game just wasn't changing enough in that time, which I think does speak to how stupid crunch is. Because it's basically what this feels like, right? It's like just 12 to 16 hours a day, just constantly trying to keep up with everything.
Right.
And really it just means, you know, you've only got a certain amount of juice that you can deploy to solve problems. And once it's gone, it doesn't matter if you keep staring at that problem for 4 more hours, you're done now.
Yep.
You got to go to bed.
Well, I don't know. Interesting is sort of post work day yesterday, because I was like, I need to work on this talk in the evening, and went home, but I was a little fried, just from, again, doing all this stuff constantly. So I was like, I'm gonna take an hour and a half or two, and I'll play with my dog, go for a walk with my wife, eat some delicious chicken, and then make some of this cream tea, which I don't know if anybody's been doing this, but I just found out that you can indeed, you put coconut milk or just milk, whatever, in a pan, heat it up, throw some tea bags in there. It becomes like the best caramel color. It's just delicious. Yeah.
This is how tea is made in most other places, probably, actually.
Well, I think there's a difference between like just throwing cream in.
Yeah, no. Yeah, making the tea in the cream. In the cream is...
And oh my God. So I had that little ritual, you know, on the stove, just doing that, stirring some tea bags in, drank my tea, and then I was ready to go. Felt great.
Yep.
Just took a little 2-hour break to get my juice refilled.
Well, and we also made a discovery last night, which is we've done a lot of talks as a studio, and... Every time we do a talk, it's always one person sort of taking ownership of it and saying like, I want to give a talk about X.
They basically turn into a hermit, right?
Yeah. And so
we banish them. We're like, go write it.
Yeah. And what we've kind of come up with is sort of for any talk that you see us give, you can assume that there was about an hour of prep for every minute of the talk. So if we give a, you know, 45-minute talk that took about 45 hours to put together, refine it, practice it, memorize various parts and then whatever. And a large part of that prep is not in the presentation practice, but actually just in structuring it and coming up with what goes into it. So Sam was working on a talk last night, and I had just finished working on mine 2 nights ago. Mm-hmm. And so Sam was like, I'm going to work on my talk tonight. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, what if I just jumped in and also helped write it? Even though it's not my talk, and even though I'm not going to be presenting it, but wouldn't it be good to just have a second person there working on it with you as like a sounding board or to help you if you get stuck on things or whatever? So Sam was like, yeah, sure. So it was
interesting because it was just very fun because we're, of course, cracking jokes all the time. It's basically like an extended version of the podcast, but with a focused, you know, through line about what we were talking about.
Yeah.
And then sort of as the person who's writing it sort of thunders forward on the keyboard, then the person who's sort of observing and acting as the sounding board can refine or ask questions or whatever else as it goes. And so like the quality just goes up. It's just a higher bar.
You catch a lot of mistakes. You catch a lot of weird structural things.
Or just weird thoughts.
Like repetition. Like we had one thing where, you know, Sam was typing and I realized like I was just reading while he was. So we were on Google Docs and then we were over voice on Discord. And there were several times where Sam would be writing stuff and as he's writing, he's just trying to get his thoughts out. So he doesn't want to have to go back and reread stuff constantly, which is where a lot of the time goes. Right. So while he was writing, I would be reading back and looking back through stuff and trying to find connections between things. And there were several points where maybe it was like the same idea was sort of repeated in 3 places, but in sort of different ways. And so then I'd be like, hold on, let's like crunch these together and find a better way to phrase it. And so, you know, it cut what would have been probably a 6 to 8 hour process down to about 2 hours.
Yeah. The comparative stuff for Seth was 6 hours, but also by yourself, not super fun. And that was the difference. Cause we got done at like 9 PM and both of us were like, well, that was fun.
All so right. Yeah. So you can do that with someone for 2 hours and have a better thing and a good time, or do it sad and lonely for 8 hours and end up with something worse.
Yeah.
So I think in the future, we're going to start doing this sort of pair talk.
Well, the best part about it was that afterwards, both of us were like, why is this the first time we thought about it?
Well, because it's just assumed if you're giving a talk, then you're the one with the idea.
Right.
And you need to put it together. But that's just crazy. Like, why? You know?
Get a buddy.
Get a buddy. Hashtag buddy system. Mm-hmm. Also, we have, we want to talk a little bit about what we talked about last week.
Yeah.
So last week we talked about satisficing versus maximizing.
And if you've been in the Discord, you've seen some continued discussion about the concepts and some other points that we wanted to bring up.
Yeah. There. And so last week in the course of our chatting about it, we highlighted sort of the sort of goofy rifts that mm-hmm. pop up in relationships when people, essentially you have like a satisficer and a maximizer. So a satisficer is somebody, just to recap, is somebody who essentially uses the good enough principle when making decisions, where they have a very specific set of standards or criteria for making a decision. So if you're a satisficer and you're like, I need to buy a pair of pants, I'm willing to spend $20 on pants and I'm just going to go to the pants shop. So the moment I see pants that A, fit, like that have my measurements, and that B, are within my budget, I buy those pants. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of my shopping trip, right? Whereas a maximizer will take the approach where they're trying to find the best thing, mm-hmm. right? So instead of adhering to a certain criteria and stopping the moment they find it, they will keep looking until they feel like they've hit what they believe to be the best, right. The best decision. And so one of the consequences of that is essentially that satisficers generally spend a lot less time making decisions because it's not really about the best. It's just finding the thing, right? So in the course of talking about it last week, we talked a lot about, you know, what this might look like in the context of relationships. Mm-hmm. And we ended up sort of focusing on the comedic side of these rifts that can pop up when you have somebody who has a satisficing behavior versus somebody who has a maximizing behavior. And so we were talking to Adam afterwards, and he correctly pointed out, he was like,
you guys fucked up.
He's like, you guys, this is not the way to talk about it, because the fact is that it's actually an opportunity to better understand how people think, and it should be treated as sort of a way of creating understanding in relationships and finding better ways to work together, not just like, well, I'm a satisficer and you're a maximizer, so I guess this is your problem now, right? And the thing we talked about last week was the idea of like doing dishes or household chores, mm-hmm. or whatever, where essentially what you'll often see in relationships is where one person has really, really low standards for all kinds of things around the house, and therefore just doesn't help. Mm-hmm. And then all of the household chores get offloaded onto the person who has the higher standard of cleanliness, right. or, you know, whatever.
Yes, we wanted to make sure we didn't actually feed into the notion that if you're the person who doesn't care, that you should be like, oh, I guess it's your problem.
Yeah. And what went unsaid last week was that if you are in the position where you're the satisficer and the other person's the maximizer, that doesn't just absolve you of responsibility to take care of shit.
Right, right.
I think importantly, it opens up the opportunity for either doing things like trying to find ways to you know, divide sections of housework up, mm-hmm. or whatever, so that the things that you care about are the things that you do, and the things that the other person care about are the things that they do. Which is that, for example, like in our household, I do the laundry and then Sampi folds the laundry, right? Mm-hmm. So we have like, we sort of split various chores and stuff, right. or we try to do things like, if one person cooks, then the other person does all the dishes, mm-hmm. from that, you know, cause it creates a mountain of dishes.
Right.
And so we try to split things up in such a way that, you know, you don't have to stress so much about those things.
Well, even if you say you can't, so in my case, like I want to be able to do the damn dishes in my house. Right.
Right.
And so, a big part of that comes down to actually assigning. I think the core problem with the satisficer maximizer sort of conflict basically becomes that there's not a resolution right in that particular combo of problems. There's not a way where you can say, okay, now I care more. It's just not necessarily going to happen. Or as a maximizer, you can say, okay, yeah, I'll accept less quality.
Yeah, because both of you have a specific standard, and it feels weird to. Like if you're a satisficer, you feel like you might feel like you're wasting time by doing extra work when you feel like you've already done the job.
And if you're a maximizer, you're like, why is there peanut butter on this knife?
Right. And so I think the phrasing that Adam used was something like, you know, you shouldn't be happy just like doing a bad job at things, right. and then making that other people's problem.
Right. But the interesting thing about it though is that I think is you have to pull in a third variable. So in the case of a relationship, the easy one and the obvious one to me is literally the happiness of the other person, which is really the actually. You know, the way to solve this problem anywhere. So if you care, for example, about the quality of the relationship or the happiness of the person involved,
which you should,
which you probably should, yeah, then that's the sort of thing that if you're either a satisficer or maximizer that you can use to say, okay, you know, in this particular instance, I will, for example, in my case, I will care more, or I will do the dishes to a higher degree of quality. Well, not necessarily because I care, but because I care about you who care.
Right. And more importantly, you are now satisficed. You're using the good enough principle for your relationship in the sense that you have a standard of happiness for your relationship, mm-hmm, that you need to make sure that you meet, right? You need to do things for the other person and make their life better.
Right.
And so you can't. So anyways, so
there's not a free pass. So just tell people to do your housework.
Basically. Right. So, you know, last week, I think the reason the conversation took this turn, I think this is actually an interesting sort of introspective point on what it means to sort of be sitting here and recording a podcast every week, is this is very free form. And really all we do is we just like have topics to talk about. Mm-hmm. And we often will like try to find like an interesting nugget, and then also kind of highlight what that means through like jokes and stories and comedy. Right. But in a lot of cases, you know, those stories might end up pointing at some like in the wrong direction, or sure, pointing people down a wrong path. And so we need to own that. We need to own that mistake. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was, sorry, guys.
Sorry.
That was on us.
Yeah, I think, and Degeki pointed out actually in the Discord a really good rule for, I think, just handling these sorts of scenarios, which is referred to as the Platinum Rule. So for those of you who are interested in that, I'm not going to follow up too much on that, but just go check it out on Wikipedia. It's the same sort of general idea, which is if you care about, you just learn how to care about other people's cares. That's it.
Yeah.
And then you do stuff for them according to that.
So it's not about the dishes. It's about the other person and respecting their well-being and happiness. Right. also, this is a really important news item. We got quite a few more news items. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a day. It's October. Sam can touch his toes now.
Yeah. So, well, it's good. I mean, let's talk about this for a sec. Cause there's a few things in my life that I've always just been like, oh yeah, I can't. I just can't do that. And then a couple weeks ago, I was looking at my fitness goals. And I think we talked about this a little bit where I was like, I'm trying to figure out what to do next. And I realized that, you know, general flexibility is not a thing I've literally ever had. And so starting a week ago, week and a half ago, I was like, I found a 15-minute stretch routine. And then about every 2 or 3 days, then I just do that stretch routine. Part of the thing I did last night when sort of my break recovery time after work. And last night I touched my toes. And I think part of it was that
my
dog, so I was leaning down to do my toe touches, and he just came and just plopped himself and just laid down right where my hands were so he could be pet. And so I think I just spent more time there because I was petting this dog.
So you accidentally stretched.
Yeah.
And then I was
trying to like reach around the other side of his rib cage, you know? And in order to do so, I had to really stretch it out. And then I touched my toes and I was like, huh.
Well, it took one of the many perks of dog ownership.
Right.
Now you can touch your toes. Well, I'm proud of you, Sam.
Well, I mean,
it took you 20 whatever years.
20 years. But yeah, I think the greater point is, you know, there's a lot of little things like that personal, like you have those weird hangups about particular things. We're like, oh, it's just never a thing I've done or it's not a thing I do. And this was sort of just a laughable one. It is laughable where it's like, yeah, it's not impressive that you can touch your toes. It shouldn't be. But I think
from you just got to stretch enough.
Really? Yeah.
You just do it. It took me a week. Well, the way that you be able to touch your toes is by just bending over for a while.
About 45 minutes.
There's not anything particularly remarkable about it. So,
but yeah, so I think, you know, it's good to remember that there's plenty of stuff that we all have that's probably fixable.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier this morning about, you know, the idea of a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset, mm-hmm, and how ideally you have a growth mindset in everything where you're always like, I just need to put time into this and do better. Right. But yeah, it is the case that no matter how good you are at that, there's probably still going to be some stuff that you have this weird mindset toward where you're just like, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. It's just the way I am. Just can't touch my toes and literally never will.
I wonder if it's like a personal scar from gym class. Do you remember that that stretch machine thing?
I do.
So they would test every year, they would test our flexibility, and you'd like put your legs into this device and then you leaned forward and you pushed this dial up. Now, however far you got was what your score was. Mm. And I was always on like the bottom of the barrel.
And this is just part of you. It's part of you now. It's just an emotional scar that you have to carry your entire life.
So I fixed it.
I signed up for a gym membership about a year ago, and they do a thing where they test for your body age. So this is so this is a thing where basically they you know, check out your like your body fat percentage, how long you can do a wall squat, how many push-ups you can do in a row, and they do flexibility tests.
Okay.
And your body age can only be so many years below your normal human age. And I missed the minimum by 1 year because I was 1/10 of an inch too short in my toe touching.
There you go.
I mean, I went past my toes, but by 1/10 of an inch, not enough to be. Also, if you are subscribing to this weird body age idea, it's literally arbitrary. It's totally made up. It's not a real thing.
Wait, how old is your body?
At the time, my body was like 26.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I could have been a 25-year-old body, but I don't have that.
You got it. I don't
have those stretches. Because we all know 25-year-olds are incredibly flexible.
They're very limber.
So, yeah. Also, we have, so we're now 2 weeks into the merch store.
Yeah.
So we can talk a little bit about that. So the merch store is over at shop.bscotcher.net. We launched it a couple weeks ago, and we were doing sort of a soft launch for our podcast listeners. So we have like mugs, posters, shirts. We do not have jorts, but we, you know, we're hoping to get those sweet, sweet cutoffs.
Uh-huh.
And it's been pretty good. We've made 22 or 20-ish total sales. And a couple of them were kind of from, you know, people just like around the town.
Right, right.
So we got about 20 sales, and somebody even bought the butter box, which is like the big package
of all of the
merch. And Monique has been doing an incredible job with that. She got us some custom tape that has the butterscotch logo on it, and she like throws a butterscotch candy into them and like writes a note. And so I don't know. I mean, a lot of these things aren't sustainable in the sense that if we got like 1,000 orders, you know, her hand would fall off if she wrote a note in every one.
We have to get like a stamp, you know?
Yeah.
It's like really
just a handwritten stamp. but it's been really good. And so if you haven't checked out the merch shop yet, that's over at shop.bscotch.net.
Yeah. And they're good.
I was gonna say my favorite item is the mug that says, "Can we not?" Because I feel like, yes. I feel like just no matter who you are, you know, bringing that into a meeting at work or something is just, it's like, it's a power move.
Yeah. Well, it's been really interesting seeing everybody's, cause people get the stuff and then of course post it in Discord, but like show some pictures of whatever they got going on. It's been super fun to see because we haven't been able to do this. And I think,
get to see some of our fans.
Yeah. And one of our people, in Discord said, someone did ask him yesterday, he's got a butterscotch shirt, and someone was like, "Hey, what is that?" And then they're like, "Oh yeah, they make good games." So it's a person who knew, right? So talk about making it visible. That was the whole point.
So that's super cool. And we have two more items to talk about on the news.
All right, what's next?
All right, next up, let's talk about hedonic adaptation. Okay, so I've been listening to, I have Audible subscription. It's fantastic. You can, you know, listen to books. It's amazing, which means if you're like, I'm going to do some dishes, going to mow, I got to go for a drive. You know, just you could, if you're doing a mindless task where you normally just like don't have to focus on it at all, yeah, listening to books is pretty nice. So I've been listening to The Paradox of Choice, and this is where the Satisficer Maximizer conversation came from. And there's also an interesting concept called hedonic adaptation. And so this is the idea that humans are very adaptable, and that's a sort of survival trait that we have that actually allows us to be incredibly resilient when things are shitty.
Mm-hmm.
So adaptability basically means, you know, no matter how bad things get, we are sort of standards for what is acceptable and sort of like where we find happiness just shift along that spectrum. So,
well, importantly, they shift back to the same place.
Actually. They always shift back to the same sort of neutral level of like, okay, you know, like, yeah, like there's that comic of that dog where everything is on fire and he's like, this is fine.
Right.
Like that's basically what it is.
Yeah. So, well, this is also, if you see, there's plenty of cities for lottery winners. Anybody who like basically humans naturally can't actually forecast. They have really bad at what's called affect forecasting, which is guessing how you're going to feel because a thing happened. People tend to overblow basically good and bad things, and then also overblow how long the effect of that will last.
Yeah.
So anybody who's had something great happen to them, or you know, had a bad breakup or something like that, you know, usually it is not as bad as you think for as long as you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, and this applies to like everything in life. So if you think about somebody like gets a fancy new car. Mm-hmm. And
first day you're like, oh my God.
Maybe it's like the first really nice car they've ever had. Mm-hmm. Right. And they're just like, yes, finally, this is amazing. And they're driving. They're like, I'm going to go for a drive. Yeah. Right. And they just like go around, show it off their car. And then like 2 weeks later, yeah, it's just their car. It's just, you know, it's just how you get around. Mm-hmm. Right. Because these things, they just kind of wear off. And so there's actually a couple really interesting implications of this, which is basically that one is that, you know, this adaptation thing is great for when things are bad because you can sort of bounce back. Mm-hmm. And it's terrible for when things are good because you keep demanding things to be better, right?
Or forgetting that they're good.
Or forgetting how good they are. Right. And so this leads to, we've talked in the past about the idea of gratitude, about mm-hmm. like practicing gratitude. And how that is actually one of the things that is just universally applicable to everyone, that if you just do this thing where you just like sort of wake up every morning and just make a list of things that you're really happy about and that you're thankful
very
for.
Very important, though. It has to be a short list.
Yeah.
Because what happens is if you demand that you list, so for example, if you say, I'm going to list three things every day that I'm grateful for, which is what I do, that's the proven way to make it so that your overall view on your life is generally just better and you have better time. If you ramp that up to like 12, it actually goes the other way. Because what happens when you're on number 7, you're like, I can't think of anything else good that happened yesterday. Because most people just can't. Yeah. And so even though there was stuff.
Just write down like 5 things.
Right. You know, 3 to 5.
3 to 5.
Don't go over that because then you're going to start negatively affecting. Right.
He's like, oh my God, I don't have that many things.
It's one of those nuanced problems, right? Where you think, it's the everything in moderation example is like perfectly instilled. Right. Because
yeah. And so this is actually, so hedonic adaptation is actually why gratitude works to improve your happiness, because it is a constant reminder. It kind of like moves you back toward that feeling that you would have had when that thing first happened, that first good thing happened. Right. So it snaps you out of that frame of mind. I think the second thing about it is that, you know, we've talked about the idea of miswanting, which is that people are, like Sam said, incredibly bad at forecasting how a thing is going to make them feel. And they always overestimate how good a thing is going to be or how bad a thing is going to be, actually. And this is because people operate on comparison points. And so in other words, if you think about like, oh man, if I won the lottery, really what you're doing is you're comparing like your current circumstance right now and thinking about like the moment that you got that money, how would you feel? And you are correct that you'd feel
real good,
real, real good, right? but what you don't think about is, how am I going to feel a year after having that money? Like, that's what people don't, mm-hmm. that's the frame of mind that people don't put themselves in. And the answer is pretty similar
to what you feel now.
To what you feel right now, which is why, you know, billionaires aren't like still suffer from the same kinds of like, you know, depression and stuff as mm-hmm. everybody else, right? Because it turns out those things, like, people are just people mm-hmm. no matter what they have. So that idea of miswanting, it just comes down to having your comparison point of where you think your happiness will be, only forecasting it into the moment of the change and comparing that to your current state. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Sher about this because he's like, there's this one thing that I am incredibly happy about all the time. Mm. It's my backpack. I was like, why is that? And he said, so first off, it's waterproof. It makes a perfect seal.
Amazing.
No water can get in there. And also it's feels pretty compact, but it's still big enough that I can get my laptop in there. My laptop mm-hmm. is huge. Mm-hmm. And I was like, except there's a reason why you're grateful for those things. And it's because A, it rains, which means every time it rains, you're like, I'm glad my backpack is waterproof.
Right. Right.
And the other thing is that your laptop is big. And if your laptop wasn't that big, then every time you put your laptop in your backpack, you wouldn't think about how big your backpack is. Right. And so these different scenarios, it's kind of like a gratitude practicing thing, because these scenarios actually serve as reminders for comparing what it could be like to not have a backpack that's exactly has
waterproof
those features,
and perfect sense.
Right? Yeah. And so I think the same thing about my hiking boots. As soon as I walk through a puddle, I'm like, yes, because they're waterproof. But I don't just think yes, just like all the time when I'm walking around, right?
It's situational.
You hit those comparison points where it does remind you of what it could be like if you didn't have that thing, right? So it's kind of like those repeatedly being thankful for your situation. So anyways, I think that's pretty interesting. And it also comes back to video games in a lot of ways, which.
Right. Well, I mean, that's sort of the hedonic treadmill, as it's referred to. And hedonic in psychology research just refers to the general affect of like happiness. But the idea of the treadmill is just that you need to constantly be changing things and ramping the reward up oftentimes in order to maintain a high level of that that hedonic, like to get that hedonic balance up and over what it normally is for a person. And that's why you see in RPGs, you know, the numbers always get bigger. You're finding like new, better loot all the time. You're getting like a new talent point, all this stuff. And right.
the game scales with you. Like your numbers get bigger and the enemy's numbers get bigger, but you still demand that that happens. Like you're still, if the game just said, hey, you're level one, here's your 3 damage sword. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's now you're going to fight an endless stream of enemies, all of which take roughly the same number right. of hits. You'd be like, well, this is dumb.
But sometimes that is possible. So a game like Rocket League, for example, no yep. number increases, but the skill cap on that is so high and the overall antics of it are so enjoyable to just participate yeah. in that it's, I mean, it's like playing kickball or something like that.
Yeah, and there's still a level of novelty and feeling of things getting better, right. of things constantly improving. Because you'll pull off moves that you didn't know were possible, or you'll right. see somebody do a move and you're like, damn, and then you want to do that.
Right. Right. I remember there's a really interesting take on this in Dragon Age 2, which I know I got a bad rap from a lot of people. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't know if it's because I didn't approach it in the same way I approached the first one, because I was like, oh, this is clearly a different game. I didn't take it as like a sequel follow-on, but it's much more action-oriented and still has a bunch of that sort of freeze-frame tactics and stuff. But they start you off in that game fully powered. Like you're wearing this just amazing
I remember this.
Set of armor. You have all of your abilities. That you eventually like will build toward later on, and then you lose all of them like within the first spoiler, right? Within the first like 5 minutes in the destroyer.
Yeah, it's not really a spoiler. It's like the beginning of the game.
So they teach you how to play with those skills, and then they take them away. And it was really interesting because actually earning them back in a way had like a real good sense to it. Where I was like,
I had the opposite effect.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because as soon as I saw what it was going to be, I felt like. The novelty of every new skill I got just wasn't there because I had already had it. You know what I mean? I wasn't gaining new skills. I was regaining shit that I'd already lost.
Interesting. Yeah. 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 I could see the frame. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So there's one more news item.
Whew, what we got?
October.
Let's go.
So this is more of a story, but it's a parable, if you will.
Yeah.
So we have a new, every now and then in the office, we have these kinds of like goofy slogans mm-hmm. that we start throwing around to kind of like encapsulate an idea. And
so hashtag buddy system is one of them.
Buddy system, which the reason that we thought about, hey, why don't we try tag teaming this, this talk, right? Mm-hmm. Was because we've been throwing around the buddy system slogan mm-hmm. in the studio, which is try to find ways to collaborate with people more. It's basically the essence of the buddy system. Right. And so, this new slogan is put on the bucket.
Yeah. Which, it might take a little unpacking. Which,
put on the bucket. So this comes down to, back when I was in high school, I joined the swim team and I was 14 and most of the people on the swim team, everybody who was good had been swimming since they were like 5.
Right.
Cause there were swim teams everywhere and I was never involved in those. And, so when I first started out, my times were, you know, not even vaguely competitive. And so at a certain point, I started learning how to swim butterfly stroke. And it turned out that I was like not great at it, but I didn't just completely die in the pool, which is how people tend to do butterfly right. at the beginning. So my coach was like, maybe there's some potential here. He's not dead. And so we talked about the idea of me trying to like really work on my butterfly stroke and get to swim at the state meet, which means I'd have like 10 years of catching up to do basically right. in terms of
a year or two.
And well, I had 4 years in high school, but I started swimming butterfly my sophomore year. So yeah, 2.5 years, right. 3 years. And so once I had that goal, my coach was brutal, like just relentless. And one of the biggest moments was we had practice after school. For a short time during the year. And at lunch that day, I ate a bunch of hot dogs. Okay. Ate a bunch of hot dogs.
Sorry, some poor decision making yeah. going on here.
And of course, lunch is at like 12:30 and then swim practice is at like 3:30, right? So
I 3 hours trying to pass them through.
3 hour stretch. Go swim, do the warm up. And then coach comes out with his bucket. He's got this bucket with a rope tied mm-hmm. to the handle. It's a big 5 gallon or 10 gallon bucket, whatever.
It's like what you see from a hardware store.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a regular old bucket. It's not like a fancy piece of sports equipment. It's just a bucket. And He's like, all right, buddy. He's like, everybody's going to swim 10 100s, you know, so you're going to go down, back, 10 times. And he's like, Coster, get over here. And he brings me over to a separate lane. And he's like, put on that bucket. I'm like, what?
How?
He's like, tie that around your waist. You're going to do 10 100s of butterfly with a bucket tied around your waist. And you're going to be dragging a bucket down and back. And I was pissed because I was like, what the hell, man? Like, look, everybody else is just doing freestyle. Right. They're just getting to swim, you know?
Why are you punishing me?
Yeah. And he was just like, the way you become the best is by swimming harder than everybody else. So maybe it seems like it's not fair that you have to put on this bucket, but if you think about it, it's actually not fair to them that we only have one bucket and that you get to swim harder than mm-hmm. everybody else. So put on the bucket. So I put the bucket on. I did 4 100s. I jumped out of the pool and I was like, I'll be right back. I ran to the bathroom. I threw up because it was horrifyingly difficult. I came back out and I'm like shaking and I'm pale, you know, he's just standing there looking at his watch. And I'm like, Coach, I threw up. And he's like, well, you better swim that off then. you're late for your next 100. So I jumped in, put the bucket back on and just kept swimming. And I did end up getting to swim in the state meet. Mm-hmm. In my senior year. And I think the important takeaway from all that is, you know, you kind of hear these goofy, like inspirational sports stories right. all the time, but they all have the same common thread, which is if you only work as hard as everybody else, then you will never do better than them. Mm-hmm. Right. Especially if you're starting behind.
Right.
And so, if you want to go somewhere, then you got to put on the bucket.
Yep.
And it's just going to suck a lot for mm-hmm. most of the time. And then eventually, you know, you come out on top. So that's our new in-house slogan for
basically when things are getting hard and you're like, I just need to like really,
I really
gotta dig into this.
I really
gotta
go. It's like, put on the bucket. It's just going to be hard sometimes if you want to really do well, yep. then that's just the way it is. So, all right. So let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your question on a future episode, you know, get over there, put your question in the box. Mm-hmm. First question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. Why do you limit the characters in the question box? I had to change hey guys to hey so my question could fit. Why do we do
this? I mean, probably because actually, if the questions were super huge and we have to scroll for a year to get everything,
but it turns out we still do now. So
that's true.
I think the better answer is Adam built the podcast page two and a half years ago. Mm-hmm. It took him like 4 hours. He built yep. the whole thing from scratch and we just needed a text box. We put it in there. And at the time we thought, yes, we don't want incredibly long questions. We want some quickies that we can just correct. Answer. Right. Mm-hmm. So, that's basically it.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't really revisited anything about the podcast page and
it's on the docket.
It's on the docket.
But October happened.
So we got October.
It's down the docket.
Yeah. So, it's no ill will. It's not that we don't want to hear, you know, what you guys have to say. It's more that we just haven't thought about it. And
I mean, there's a lot of beauty in being concise. So, you know,
it's just consider it a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, put on the bucket. just really pack in a real meaty question.
Yeah. Every word counts.
Yeah. All right. Degeki says, choices lead to events, which lead to choices. Is making the wrong choice possible? Is it just a matter of better or worse? How can perspective flip the definition? Could making the wrong choice actually lead to a better outcome than the right one?
This is interesting. Okay. So there's some really interesting psychology about personal narratives, which I think comes into play here.
Yeah.
Because, and we've said this before, but it is true that you cannot A-B test the universe, which means any path that you go down versus one you did not go down.
That's just your path now.
You don't know. We don't even know what's going to happen. So there's a really interesting thing that happens when you ask people to sort of retrospect about their lives, which is there's a narrative there, right? There's always sort of like, oh, this happened, and so I did this, and then that allowed me to do this, and this happened.
Even that swimming story I told, I mean, I'm pretty sure it didn't happen exactly like that
right.
because it was like a million years ago. I'm just dredging. I'm recreating mm-hmm. this thing from my new current perspective.
Right. Right? But there's a lot of really interesting stuff that goes into how your current mood, even when you're retrospecting, can affect what memories you pull up and then also how you sort of reshape them. And the important note here is just that your memory is complete nonsense for the most part. and very, very malleable. So if you pull up, for example, if you say, okay, I'm gonna remember this relationship I had, and I'm gonna purposefully remember it while I'm kind of angry, for example. So you got a bad relationship, you broke up or something. When you recall the events of that relationship, you won't recall actually all the good stuff about it. You're going to be recalling more likely the stuff that has that same sort of negative affect attached to it.
And you're generally going to recall it in such a way that makes you look like the protagonist.
Correct. Right? So, well, this is an interesting point, because I think there's that question of, you know, is there, I definitely think there's is the case that there are bad choices for sure. There are also better and worse outcomes. But the problem is that, you know, if it depends on the time scale you're looking at, really, right? Because if you look over the whole arc of your life and you're telling the story about it, everything makes sense.
Yeah, because Right? Everything got you to exactly this point.
Exactly. And so
everything happened for a reason.
Yeah. And I think the thing people don't necessarily realize is the reason is something that you rationalize on the back end.
Yeah, so for example, it's a story that you weave back together.
Yeah, and we also know that, you know, for a lot of people, the biggest growth moments actually come from a lot of times the worst decisions, or like being thrown into the worst circumstance, right? My own case with being sick, in the case of like our parents getting divorced and a bunch of other stuff that's happened in our lives, the stuff that you'd normally consider the bad stuff is oftentimes, in retrospect,
it's the stuff that helps shape you the most,
the richest stuff,
into
right?
something good.
Right. And so I think it's just a weird thing, because if you shift the time scale for most of these things, and this goes back to the hedonic balance question, actually, it's usually very hard to as a person to like maintain a negative viewpoint of an event that happened in the past as that event continues to recede into the past, because you will be able to sort of continue figuring out how it is that event has like positively shaped what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, like, the gratitude practice, that's actually what it does. So for example, some of the times when I do that little gratitude practice either in the morning or at night, the thing that I realize I'm most thankful for was the shittiest thing that happened that day. By far, because oftentimes it's like, oh, you know, I like this horrible thing happened, but as a result of that, I actually worked through this thing that I frankly just should have, you know, not been doing, or right. I got closer to this person who I had a fight with, or whatever else. And so I think time scale is a really interesting component.
I think it's time scale, but it's also, there's two parts to it, right? There's the event, and then there's just what you do afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's not about like the choice leading to the event defining whether the choice was good or bad necessarily, because there's a third factor, which is after you are confronted with the consequence of your choice, what are you going to do about that? Right. Which is where, you know, Degeki says choices lead to events, which lead to choices. And I think that third part, that next choice after the event, is the thing that really defines mm-hmm. sort of how impactful and what the effect of that event is going to be.
Absolutely.
Because you get to decide how you're going to react to bad or good situations. Mm-hmm. And whether you, you know, put on the bucket, rise to the challenge,
and sometimes you are put into a situation where it is genuinely just like the most terrible thing. But then the decision might not actually be yours at that point. I think this is an interesting thing as far as, you know, sort of dealing with troublesome events of your past downstream, is that, there are ways like with, you know, modern therapy, or just like a lot of creating a really good network of friends and a good community that can help you through stuff, to actually, again, reshape those events in your past that were either super dark or terrible or whatever else into just a piece of your past that's sort of like a piece of the whole puzzle, rather than being this sort of standout negative stone of
yeah, pain. And trying to figure out, you know, what, how to extract lessons from that mm-hmm. and turn that into something that you can use going forward to make your life better going forward.
Right.
It's not about, choices aren't inherently bad always. Sometimes they are, but I mean, let's not. Yeah, sure. Choices aren't always inherently bad or good, and events aren't always inherently bad or good, because it's a combination then of just what your reaction to all that right. stuff is.
And this is, I mean, it does actually kind of go into the Stoic philosophy, which is that basically things happen. What are you going to do about it is the most important part. How you react to a thing is the only part of that that you actually have control over. So if something bad happens, are you able to, for example, mine the silver lining out of it for yourself? Yep. Or is it going to be baggage?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And we would assume that anytime you make a choice, you are doing so with the best information that you have at the time. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, because it's rarely that somebody is like, all right, I can do these two things. I'm pretty sure choice A is the best thing to do. I'm going to do choice B, right? Like, that just doesn't happen. People do the best with the information they have right. and the framing they have and their you know, life perspective and the lessons they've learned and all that. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't think it really helps to frame it as like a wrong choice or a right choice. It's just all about your reaction.
Yeah.
So, all right. So next question comes from La Destitute, who says, I've been trying lately to improve my productivity and efficiency by a whole bunch since I, which is about 18%. That's how much that is.
It's a good amount.
Since I juggle a YouTube channel, game development, studying for IT certs, exercise, and more.
Whew.
Do any of you awesome fellas have any tips for productivity and such? So probably my first thing would be maybe shave down that list of things to focus more on, you know, a fewer number of things. Because I don't know what and more entails, but before that, there's still a lot of things.
My big question is actually a time scale question again.
Yeah.
Because I found when I first started doing any of the self, like productivity or self help stuff, the focus that I had was so intense on a day, like the time scale of a day. Where I was like, all right, so all these things are important to me. Socializing, for example.
Which means I need to do every one of them.
Exercising, working on my game dev, all the stuff.
Every single day.
Right. And so I had this period, I think it was like a 3-week period or so, where I just packed everything into every single day. And it was completely exhausting. So I think
actually— Was this when you did the Uberman sleep schedule?
That was actually after that. Okay. But yeah. But yeah, so one of the biggest lessons I think for me personally trying to hit a better stride with productivity is to identify the time scale that you're happy filling those various buckets. Like, I think it's actually totally fine to have that many things going on, sort of in flight, but it depends on the time scale. Because if you're trying to do every single one of those every single day, you're going to have a bad time.
Well, it depends on your time scale and your goals. So, for example, like, if you want to make it, so, you know, it says juggling a YouTube channel. So, if you want to make a successful YouTube channel, one of the things that's generally pretty well known at this point about how to do that is that you need a constant content delivery, mm-hmm. right? Which means, unfortunately, that is something that if you want to have a successful YouTube channel, you might need to do it every day.
Right.
Or
depending on the type
or, like, of content. Or rather, you'll probably have to even work on it every day, even if you don't get a video out every day, because it does take a lot of work. Right. And so, some of these things do kind of demand different levels of involvement in different timescales, mm-hmm. like exercise as well. You got to do it pretty frequently.
Right.
It's not like something you just do once a month and just like, hey, I did it. I'm mm-hmm. in shape again.
Right.
I'm good now.
Well, the thing that helped me a bunch was just saying, I realized that I think my optimal sort of time scale for asking that question, have I filled all my buckets that I've got, was somewhere between like 7 to 10 days. If about every like 10 days, for example, I went to the gym like 3 or 4 times. I saw some friends like twice, put in some amount of hours into game dev, read a book or something like that. Then I was very happy with that sort of chunk of time.
Yeah.
But anytime I tried to reduce that, because of the number of things I was doing,
burnout.
Then I get burned out.
Yeah.
So I think that is a good point, which is maybe, you know, if you can focus on a particular thing, that always helps because it allows you to not feel like you're always failing in some domain, which is a big part of the problem.
Because yeah, there's opportunity cost for everything that you're doing.
So if there's anything that you really want to lean hard into, then just do that thing. And if not, then have a longer time scale in which you're deciding whether or not you're doing a good job and sort of filling those buckets.
Yeah. But really it just depends on your goals.
Yeah.
So if you are approaching these things from a hobby perspective, we're like, I just like, you know, tinkering in Game Maker. Yeah. I just like making YouTube videos Absolutely. For fun. I'm not trying to turn it into a career. I'm not trying to like become a hit YouTube sensation or mm-hmm. whatever. Then just do whatever.
Yeah.
You know, because then it's not really about productivity. It's just about having fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of a different spin on it.
Right.
So it really just honestly depends on your goals and trying to evaluate based on what I would like to accomplish in these domains. What should my time spend look like on a daily or weekly basis? Mm-hmm. And if I'm not there, what do I need to cut or add or whatever? So yeah, just maybe do that comparison.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next question comes from Rampandapus, who says, if Crashlands had been review bombed at launch, how do you think that would have affected your sales? Personal note, the extremely high review score for Crashlands in the iOS App Store was what made me check out the game, the studio, and the podcast.
Well, so here's a funny note. Sort of the reverse problem, which is particularly in the App Store, our reviews were so high that people started accusing us of buying the reviews.
Right.
So that was a weird thing.
Well, especially considering, I mean, our review scores were high on Steam as well, but from PC and like from desktop reviewers, like critics, like legit critics, our review scores were far lower.
Right.
And so there was
75.
Yeah. So there's like this mismatch there.
Right.
It's kind of like if you see like a Rotten Tomatoes and you're like, critics are like 18% and the audience is like 93%. You're like, what?
It's a good popcorn movie. Not much else, right?
Something weird is happening.
But yeah, so I think if we would have gotten review bombed, I mean, I assume it would have done something bad, especially during launch.
Would it though?
But that's the thing. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, because you know what happens when a game gets review bombed is a lot of people know about it. And then they have to buy it so that they can review buy it, right. Or they have to already own it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I mean, to me, the craziest example of all this stuff is No Man's Sky, yeah. And how
still
every day they get review bombed by thousands and thousands of negative reviews, and that means they're making that many sales. So people are still buying the game. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't know if anybody's done a real study on whether or not review bombs hurt sales of the game or help.
I think they
or
do
nothing.
They actually do give you extra press is the thing.
Yeah. Cause controversy
it's great.
Generates news.
Yeah. So, but I think in the case that you're like a small potato person, like I think us in particular, if we say we've gotten review bombed by even like 100 people at once early on, no one cares enough about us to be like, oh my God, there's a review bomb happening to this game that no one has ever played nor cared about. It's not going to be an article written, right? There's going to be no silver lining on that.
Right, but the review bomb has to happen for a reason. Like, there has to be a horde of people mad about something. Mm-hmm. Like, that's news, right?
Right.
Like, that's going to generate news. I don't know what the thing is.
Right.
But, I mean, because I think the fact that you got review bombed is news because people love talking about outrage.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. So, it's delicious. So,
and especially, you know, like, Twitter is the greatest place in the world mm-hmm. to create like a rage echo chamber. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure lots of people would hear about your game through Twitter middle of a review bomb campaign. So, yeah. So we actually can't say, I mean, it seems like a review bomb is bad and it probably is in the long run because of the suppression of your,
right.
Of your sales. But I do think it stands to reason that it would generate some level of news interest.
Sure.
So who knows? All right, Angry Muffin says, since the launch of iOS 11, the whole damn world seems absolutely obsessed with augmented reality. Is this something you guys care about or think you may ever dabble in?
I would love to dabble in it later on, especially with like being able to bring, in a similar way like Pokemon Go did, right? Being able to bring a IP that's already successful just as a game and then mm-hmm. sort of mix and match it for an AR thing. But I think I view it in the same way that the VR thing is, which is, it's not necessarily like everyone keeps pointing to Pokemon Go as an example of how AR is, you know, can be done to make a bajillion dollars, but it's Pokemon.
Well, and I think importantly, AR was not actually the thing that made it successful. It was the fact that people had to go out like, well, first starts,
well, it was Pokemon.
It was Pokemon, but yeah. Also the social proof of seeing people out catching Pokemon, they didn't have to broadcast the Pokemon out onto the world, and also they didn't actually do it very reliably either.
Right.
You know, like I remember when I first booted it up, I was in my office and I was like, there's a Pokemon around, and I turn and it's just like levitating in the leg of my desk. Like, that's not really augmented reality. You're just putting a 3D image of a Pokemon arbitrarily
on a video.
On a video.
Right. Well, I think to me it's still a very early, I guess if you want to call it a different industry from something like AR, VR and video games generally. It's still very early and it's really cool. It's super cool.
Yeah.
But there's always that question of kind of like VR. With VR, you have to wear like a helmet and goggles the whole time you're playing, you're like doing VR, right?
Right.
With AR, you have to like whip your phone around to look at stuff. And so I'm just not sure, you know, as far as the general comfortable use case for most people, I think it's a fun toy right now, I guess is the way I'd put it.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's going to necessarily breach into like full blown true like market hysteria, or if this is similar to what happened with VR, which is actually the reason you're hearing so much about it is because all the platforms are pushing it.
Yeah.
That's why all the platforms are very interested in AR and they're pushing devs to actually get more involved in making it, even though there might not necessarily be a big market for those devs.
I think it's because, you know, in a lot of cases we're talking about hardware manufacturers.
Correct.
And so they got to get people pumped about the next big thing. My concern with it is more of, I don't believe that we need more layers of technology between ourselves and the world. I think we've reached a saturation point where it's like, I bought a wristwatch not because I don't know what time it is, because I do have a phone that tells me what time it is, but more because I don't want to look at my phone.
Right.
because my phone is not a single function device. And every time I pull it out, it's trying to get me to do stuff. It's got it. Even if it's not directly sending me alerts, there's so many things I can do. And I can read a book. I can watch movies. Mm-hmm. I can check my email. I can do literally anything to communicate with people or to feel like I'm communicating with people. And so when I open my phone to check the time, oftentimes I just will fall down these habitual rabbit holes of like just doing all these other things. In other words, it's because it's not a single function device. It's very distracting, which is why I love pen and paper. Because if I need to actually think about things, I need to get away from screens. I need to get away from things that can pull my attention away. Mm. And so the thing that I'm becoming more of a Luddite as I get older because of the fact that, you know, growing up pre-internet and remembering what it was like to like look people in the eyes and just talk to them.
Right. Or if you're sitting at like a stop or something. Everyone's just sitting there. So
yeah. Or the weird kind of like pride and satisfaction that comes from, cause I even like, I was driving before GPS was a thing, you know, and that weird level of satisfaction with like looking at a map and being
getting
like
to a place,
being like, how do I get there? Right. And kind of plotting your course and then actually just like looking out into the world and being like, there's that road I need to turn at. Right. And thinking about what you're doing. Whereas, you know, now we offload all that onto GPS.
So I guess what's your concern? How does AR roll into that?
So, I mean, the thing about AR is that the trajectory that people are trying to push it in is sort of the Google Glass, the HoloLens, basically these gadgets that you slap in front of your eyes. And now no matter what you do, there's always going to be some kind of layer.
Escape.
Yeah. There's gonna be some kind of a layer of apps between your face and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe there could be some fun AR games. I am dubious that it necessarily, like, it's just different. It's not necessarily better, right? I'm skeptical that you could make a way better AR game than you could make just a regular video game. Which isn't to say you can't make a good one. I just think it's just a different platform.
Different thing.
Right. Yeah. It's like Virtual Boy versus Oculus versus Game Boy versus whatever. And so I am not super pumped about just the concept of augmented reality in general. People need to use their brains more and their eyes and their ears and stop offloading things so much onto apps and screens.
So you're worried about a future in which there's just...
You ever see
more
Wall-E?
Shit in your face? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's, you worried about Wall-E?
That's augmented reality. You know, everybody's just floating around on their chairs with a screen between them and the world, right? And that's how they experience life, right? So, which does, of course, sound weird coming from a video game developer.
Well, a friend of mine works in software, and he was over the other day, and he was using, there's some like computer vision thing that he'd been working on his phone. And so you can point it at stuff and it'll tell you what it is. So just looking around, and it's like house plant.
And you're like, oh, so chair. That's what that is.
Yeah, it's like, this funny moment. I was like, okay. I mean,
well, of course. I mean, I'm excited about these things because of the prospect of what they can lead to, not just what they are, right?
Absolutely.
Which is like, if a machine can look at something and know what it is, then that's obviously part of the path toward legit artificial intelligence, right? Of like general artificial intelligence, a machine that can exist in the world like a person and can learn and see everything and understand everything, and which is super cool. And I think,
yeah, I guess, well, that's where
it's going to put us into a position where humans become redundant.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I think where I'm at with AR thing is sort of, it is very cool. That's just where I'm at with it.
It's just cool.
It's very cool, but I don't necessarily think there's a huge market opportunity there right now.
It has to reach a certain usability and practicality threshold.
Correct.
You know, because even when Google Glass came out, that was what, 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, it's so cool. And then nobody bought it because, you know.
Because it was freaky. People are like videotaping your face all the time. Yeah. It's like, stop.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't want it to be the case that when I'm looking at somebody in conversation that they just have a camera pointed at me just the whole time. It's just weird. It's not right.
But maybe that'll change, you know? Kids these days grow up, just point cameras at each other. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're pointing cameras at themselves constantly with, you know,
that's true,
selfies. So what's the difference if somebody else is pointing the camera? You're already recording yourself, you know, just get more footage while you're at it. So
we'll see what happens.
We'll see. I don't know. The industry is constantly changing. There's a great article on PC Gamer about Overgrowth. And they were talking about how the fact that Overgrowth took 9 years to develop. It's a game that just came out like this week today. And took 9 years to develop. And they were like, this game was started development before the first Android phone.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It hasn't even been a decade. And I now have, you know, I have a Galaxy S5 and I'm like four generations behind or whatever. These amazing devices that we just all carry in our pockets and take for granted, which didn't even exist when this game started being released. So, you know, projecting into the future is always weird because we're just always wrong about it. Yeah. So anyways, so that's all the time we've got for this episode.
Hopefully we'll have Adam around next week. Yeah. Yes, dead.
Unless some other crazy thing happens.
It is October.
It is, yeah. It'll still be October next week.
Oh, God. Sadly. So.
It just keeps being October. Anyways, so we'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, and our producer, Fat Bard, for putting this episode together. And the B-Scotch dev team, Andy, Tifa, and Sher, for having our backs while we record this podcast. Special thanks to the community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. If you'd like to get more involved in the B-Scotch community, head over to our Discord server at bit.ly/BSDiscord and come say hi. Also, if you would like to adorn your body with butterscotch merch, check out our shop. It's over at shop.bscotch.net. We got all kinds of sweet swag, including some fantastic bundles and, of course, the Can We Not mug. Mm-hmm. Also, if you'd like to adorn our bodies with your swag, we have a mailbox. So if you want to send us something, you can head on over to mailbox.bscotch.net. And we do have alerts hooked up to that thing, so we will know when your package arrives, so we will get it in a timely fashion, so don't fear. Also, we depend on great reviews to get new listeners, so if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, help us out by heading over to bit.ly/CWBApple and give us a 5-star review. It'll help other people find us, and it'll also help us promote the podcast onto other platforms. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.